Hello everyone and welcome to this book launch. I'm very proud and very honored to be with my friend Sorin Mureșan and to host the launch of his book Social Market Economy, The German Model. I will make a short introduction and then Sorin will present briefly the philosophy of his book and the book itself. And then we have quite very famous panelists who will comment on the book. So thank you for being with us today. I would like to say a few words about the book. It's presenting the German economic system from an external perspective, and it's looking at the extent to which it enabled the country to increase its weight into international relations. What is very special about this book is the link which Sorin Mureșan makes between the economy, the international position of Germany, and therefore the international relations in the area, in the world, and also the relationship between religion, art, ethics, morals, education, and economy. And it shows and it proves in this book that nothing can be taken only as a discipline. We cannot only talk about and be specialized in economy and write about economy and build a successful economic model only by being an economist and looking at the economy. We have to look at the, all the other aspects of the society and of human nature, as I said, including education, religion, moral, culture, all these together build the economy and the international position of the country of which economy we are represented in this book. Now, Sorin has been published a lot. He's working, he has many positions, so I'll try to say a few of them. His main areas of academic research are foreign policy, international economics, theology, and parliamentary history. So very diverse. That's, we live the world where interdisciplinary people should rule the world. He is affiliated to the Altiero Spinelli Center for the Study of European Organization of University Babeș-Bolyai from Cluj-Napoca. He worked for several years as a senior diplomat in the Romanian embassy in Germany. He now partly lives in Germany, where he pursues the challenge of bringing Eastern and European Europe together in the business, academic and political fields by applying the motto Ex Oriente Lux, Ex Oriente Lex of the German-Romanian Academy. He's also vice president of the Romanian-German Academy since 2014. He received in 2010 the scientific award for history Eudoxiu Hurmuzaki of the Romanian Academy, and he teaches since 2012 economic diplomacy for international students at the University of Applied Science, Würzburg. He also had been invited repeatedly to lecture at various political foundations and universities in both Germany and Romania. I have to say how we met. We met here, he called, he said, I'd like to meet you, who are you? He made a short introduction and then we had a first meeting in my office, and this was, we liked each other from the very first moment. We had things to discuss in common, and this was the beginning of, let's say, mutual friendship and scientific and professional friendship. So before coming to Brussels, one day before, I received an SMS, I'm coming to Brussels, are you free? This is how we live today in this world. We meet people in planes, in restaurants, on the street, in the parliament, in all places we live and work and go on holiday. And we make, as I said, we discover the world, we discover friends, and including professional friends, which are very valuable. So, as we said, we live in a very broad world, which has changed, and every relationship is important if we know what to take from it and what to learn from each other, because we each have to learn from each other. I will stop here. I don't want to make an essay. I will give the floor to Sorin, if you want to add something about your background or your professional career, which I didn't mention. Please do.
Thank you, Monica, very much, and thank you for hosting the event and being open for having an interdisciplinary presentation. I will not add anything about my career, so I think we will have some words from Academician Marcos about me, and I think it's the others who have to say something about you, not yourself. So I leave that to the others. Just a few words about the other panelists, and I'm very glad that we have an interdisciplinary panel. We have from Romania, Academician Solomon Marcos, who is probably, I would say, the most renowned and also professionally able public academic in Romania. He's in debates in national TV most of the time in various topics, from mathematics to literature. We have Professor Andreas Freitag, who is a university professor at the University of Jena and the chair of economic policy. He's at the same town where the founder, one of the fathers of the social market economy, namely Walter Eucken. He was a professor of economics in Freiburg in the 1920s, 1930s, and I'm glad to have the same connection again here in this panel with the social market economy, a concrete connection. Then we have Dirk Hazel from London. He is president of the United Kingdom European Popular Party. He was a conservative British member of parliament, and when the UK left, when the Conservative Party left the EPP, Dirk preferred to stay in, let's say, in the European family, and I'm glad to hear his view on how we deal with Europe in the future. And we have Matthias Bauer. He is a senior economist at the European Centre for International Political Economy in Brussels. He is researching on international trade and finance, and worked for several multinational corporations as an economist. More you can see in the presentation of the CVs which we put on the tables. And I have to say, unfortunately, we cannot. I would like to give a book to everybody who took the pains to come here. To give a free copy, but I, as an author, I have only received very few copies. And unfortunately, we cannot offer, so there will be a table circulating, or I think it was put there at the entrance. If you want to stay in touch to discuss these issues after that, we can stay in touch by email. And if you want to, you would have to order a book, either a copy book or an e-book. I would give I prepared some slides to show you what the book is dealing about. The monitor is a bit small, but you will hear what I say. So some of the pictures will probably not be so visible. Important is that I cover all the aspects of the book, and then we'll have some inputs from each of the panelists here. Then we open for discussion, and we would like, if possible, to have an open discussion, critical also debate. I like debate very much, so it's good to exchange ideas and sometimes to see that I'm not able to cover all the fields.
And write another book.
Thank you. Okay, I hope this works. Yeah, it's small, but... So, the book has 7 chapters. And I studied, I researched in an interdisciplinary way, so I studied all of the aspects of the model of the social market economy. There is an introduction, There is a chapter on philosophical and historical roots, chapter 2, for the social market economy, where we deal in context with the European and German historical and political context, going back to German identity, history, a political context. Then we go to a chapter 2, is a chapter of Christian and secular philosophy, which means that we have in the model of economic organization, we have Catholic social teaching, Protestant social teaching, we have Jewish contributions, we have secularization, which we have after the French Revolution, we have liberalism. So all of these political ideologies are important for defining laws and institutions, legislation and institutions. Without these principles, we cannot do politics, in fact. So that's why I felt it necessary to study what are these political ideas behind laws and institutions. Then there is a chapter about the Freiburg circles in the interwar period, which means between 1920 and 1940, before the war began, when a number of scientists from Germany, professors of economics, lawyers, they were studying an economic model to implement in Germany after the dictatorship will be over. Then I analyzed models of capitalism in other countries, Anglo-Saxon and Rhineland capitalism, this is a comparative economics chapter. We analyzed, looked a little bit on the American model, the Dutch model, the Swedish model, the Italian model, and the German model. And this is put in context with the philosophical, political ideas before. Then there is a chapter 4 about Chapter 4 is about the pillars, the principles of the social, of the political principles, institutional principles, legislative principles. Chapter 4 is the one in the middle of the page. Chapter 5 is a historical chapter which starts from 1945 and sees how the economy of Germany has grown over the years, with building legislation and institutions. The latest figures are from 2010. Chapter 6 is about what is on the horizon, what is the future. Chapter 7 is a chapter analyzing the international position of Germany, which has been consolidated, which means the international political position of Germany has been consolidated and its political weight has increased because of the economic weight. Then there are a lot of appendices, charts, statistical data. Why? That was the content of the book. Why did this research? In fact, it was in Romania first. We looked in the 90s, in the transition, what kind of models are on the market. And because I spoke German, I worked in the parliament in Bucharest, I looked at Germany. Some other colleagues look at other countries. Then after the 2007 crisis, now there is a new need, so from another perspective, to look what kind of systems can we put in place to address globalization, not to be surprised by globalization. In other context, is the social market economy an example for adapting, for adjusting, for building wholly new national economic system to the changed international post-conflict order? Also because the term social market economy in English is not really known, there is not much literature. Main literature is in German, some of the literature in English is written by Germans, and it is not very public. And the social market economy is mentioned in the European Union Lisbon Treaty at Article 3.3. It was introduced in order to give an orientation for political economy to address the crisis. And also because another reason why I did this research, because the economic level, the economic size of Germany is the largest in Europe with 2,500 billion euros GDP per year. It's the largest economy out of the 13,000 billion euros, which is the whole European Union GDP. Essentialist for this book, namely the context in which these fathers of the social market economy build a system, and they build it in the context of the religious roots of our political and social convictions. So that was the beliefs which they had while being politicians at the same time. What are the findings? The findings are that the social market economy ranges around two mainstream capitalisms, Anglo-American and Rhineland capitalism. There is a Confucianist Chinese capitalism, but that's something else. The model of Germany is Anglo-American and Rhineland. And the political economy which is being applied can be done in three styles: liberal, social, democratic, or corporatist. Corporatist means group-based. Lawyers together, doctors, engineers, that's corporatist model. In this context, looking at US model, we saw that it's an individualist system. It has a lot of innovation drive. The sky is the limit. And the charity, which means social security, is rather private. It's not institutional. It's not public character. It has public effect, but it's not public driven. It's private driven. In the Netherlands, we have an individualistic, entrepreneur-driven market economy. The originally church-run solidarity in the 19th century until about the 1960s was nationalized into a state-driven, and that's a special concept for the Dutch economy, which is called consortiation. It's a difficult word, but it's consortiationalism. It's specific for the Dutch economy. In Sweden, we have a sort of capitalistic socialism, where companies are seen as a necessary evil, but it's good to be prepared to defend yourself against them. In Italy, we have a civil market economy system, and is applied in the uncompleted definition of nation-building policies. So the Italians don't have, they do a lot of talking in relation to building system, but when it comes to act, it's weaker. In Germany, as I said, we have corporatism, and the market economy from before 1933 is built and transformed after 1945 into a social market economy system. So the corporatist model has been transformed into a social market economy system after 1945. So the findings, which is important to say very clearly here, is that the social market economy is not a social economy. It means it's not the economic sector dealing with socially disadvantaged citizens, with disabled or handicapped, so state-run housing for the poor. No. The social market economy is a market-based economy, which, if it is run well through an economic style adapted to the identity of the citizens, the system produces results which have socially positive effects, in the sense that nobody needs social security to be given to them by the government. So if everybody is successful in his business, you don't need social protection, you don't need the social insurance. Essential also for the social market economy is the order liberalism, which is the third way in political economy, which means the state makes the rules but does not intervene in economic processes between companies. This is what it was intended. What is also important to say as a finding is that the German identity is an identity of builders of system. This country has a vocation or has a specialization in building system, not only mechanic system, but also systems of political economic organization. Some other countries have other vocations. And I think essential here is also to, from a theological perspective, to have every country come to do what they are best at doing. Then we all can profit from it. And also essential, and last point to the findings, the system is not applicable in other countries without adaptation to national identity, which means you cannot just take the German system or also Austrian system, sometimes similar, or Swiss system, and just take it to another country. You have to adapt it to the national identity and capabilities of that people. Regarding the basis of the social market economy, it's important to remember that we have two schools of thought. First is the Freiburg school, which is on the right, which is like rather liberal, and it was represented by the professors Walter Eucken, Franz Böhm, Wilhelm Röttgen, and Ludwig Erhard. Ludwig Erhard was the federal minister of economy and was also chancellor for 3 years after Adenauer. Walter Eucken comes from Jena, where Professor Freitag is a professor now. And Franz Böhm wrote the cartel legislation, the legislation regarding competition, and also negotiated the bilateral friendship treaty between Germany and Israel in 1952. They started negotiating. The other school of thought was Alfred Müller-Armack, Ludwig Erhard, he was in both schools, and Alexander Rüstow. Alfred Müller-Armack was a state secretary for economy in the Ministry of Economics in the 1950s and 1960s. He was, in fact, one of the first to use this term, social market economy. And Alexander Rüstow was a theologian and social scientist who came back to Germany after being exiled in the 1930s. He came back, moved back to Germany from Turkey. The principles of the Freiburg School, and this is something which are the principles according to which the legislation and German institutions have been built, and they are still acting now, even though at the moment they are not respected as they have been created at the moment when they have been created. Economic freedom and responsibility. We are free, but we have to be responsible. The principle of trial and error. In a free society, you can try and you can make a mistake. So this should not be blamed. When you make mistakes, not only success is good, but also to make mistake is good. It belongs to the system. The important thing is to stand up again. The principle of the invisible hand, converging offer and demand. Who can guarantee in a free market economy that offer and demand will meet? The principle of interdependency of orders. Social order, cultural order, economic order, political order, they all belong together. We cannot think of one without thinking about the other. Ethics, private property, there are some discussions here, is private property socializable in a force majeure case? There is a theological doctrine which says from Thomas Aquinas that in case of absolute circumstances, private property should become common. It would be set off. Competition. Principle of competition in market economics. Then there is a very important issue, especially what we have now, the constancy and forecasting ability of the economic policy. Economic policies should be constant, otherwise we cannot plan to our business plan. I also have a business, and if I cannot plan at least 5 years ahead, I will not do any investment. If a government changes policy from one day to another, I will stop doing any business. I have to see that my figures are running. Currency stability is essential. You have the question of the central bank, the independence of the central bank from political interference. That was an original principle. The principle of subsidiarity, and also an important an Ordo Manifesto of 1936. It's a manifesto, political manifesto by these professors who said we have to make an liberalism which is based on order. It's good to have liberalism, but within a stable legislative context. Then the social liberal school of Cologne, they have other principles. Christianity, Germanism, social market economy as an autonomous school of thought, macroeconomic intervention. In crisis situation, the government should be allowed to spend money which it doesn't have, which means to make or taxpayers' money, or to take debt, which they cannot we don't know when they can pay back. Keynes' theory. Solidarity. Then we have the principle of form society. Form society which means these political economists, they said we have to have a mature society. Only mature population can create good products and can be really independent. A special concept is also called soziale irenik, which means homogenization of different viewpoints of members of society, which means we all have to participate together to the same goal, let's say to have a good life or whatever the purpose of the society is. And this concept, soziale irenik, means converging different viewpoints. Then we have the social state, the caretaker state. For example, caretaker state is that the principle of the absolute social minimum, which means nobody should be allowed to starve in a developed economy. In this case, in Germany, it means everybody has the right to survive and will be paid some money in order to survive. There's a chart with all the principles written down. Essentially, is to know this is the right column is the market economy, which are legislation institutions. The left column is social order, and the center the environment. The basis is the Marshall Plan 1948-52, the Economic Constitution of 1949, the Federal Constitution of 1949, and to the right, the basis of the column is the economic and monetary reform. Just the last slide, and I will stop. There are disadvantages and advantages. One of the economic, international events what happened is that the economy of Germany, because of this system, has made the country able to have 5% of its GDP, which means 125 billion a year, current account surplus. Which means it exports more than it imports. And this current account surplus is disturbing some other countries. The disadvantages of the system is that it is dependent of the ability of the international customers to pay for German exports. So there is a need of stability to international trade and finance structures. Otherwise, there is no international trade possible. So Germany will always be interested to have something to say in the international dimension, international security order. And I stop here. Some of the ideas which I wrote will be discussed later. If you want to write your name in the table, we'll be happy to stay in contact after that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sorin. I have a proposal, if you agree. You have the slides, so we can send them to those interested, the slides, by email or in print, and so they will have basically a very brief resume of your book, because it was very, very little. Now, I'm very honored to give the floor to academician Solomon Marcus, and before I will say please speak, let me say a few words, because also we have many Romanians in the room. To me, he's a life legend, and we know him from among others from the very famous 10 needs a human being has. And I will also say it in Romanian, cele 10 nevoi pe care un om trebuie să le aibă. And I will take the opportunity as I'm moderating to read them very briefly in English and in Romanian. Prima, nevoia de a da un sens vieții la nivel elementar. Măcar o dată pe zi, savurează faptul că respiri, că privești cerul și pământul, că te miști. Trăiește-le ca mari evenimente. In English, the need to give a sense to life at a basic level. The second need, the need to get fresh, nevoia de împrospătare. Respirația și mișcarea sunt cu noi tot timpul. Există riscul, tentația ca ele să devină rutină, să nu le acordăm nicio atenție, cum se întâmplă în general. Rutina nu poate și nu trebuie să fie eliminată total, dar avem nevoie de împrospătare. A treia nevoie, nevoia de întrebare și mirare. Și trebuie să ne întrebăm și să ne mirăm tot timpul, așa cum fac și copiii. The need to question and to wonder. A patra nevoie, nevoia de îndoială și de suspiciune. The need to doubt and the need to challenge and to ask questions all the time. Și iarăși totul pornește din copilărie. Ce poate fi mai uman decât ezitarea, nehotărârea, nedumerirea? A cincea nevoie, the need to get wrong and the need to fail. Nevoia de greșeală și nevoia de eșec. Dacă nu greșim și nu avem eșecuri, nu mergem înainte și nu se poate o viață în care să nu greșim și să nu avem eșecuri. De câte ori am eșuat până să deprindem să folosim furculița, cuțitul și lingura, de pildă. Iarăși începem din copilărie. A șasta nevoie, nevoia de joc, the need to play. Apreciez jocurile bazate pe reguli prestabilite, de la fotbal la tenis, la șac și la fotbal. Ele au un rol important și merită atenția tinerilor. A șaptea nevoie, the need to identity, nevoia de identitate, e o provocare majoră, dramatică și o șansă de a da vieții noastre o motivație superioară. A opta nevoie, nevoia de omenesc și de omenie, the need to be human and the need to behave like a human. Identitatea este primul termen al unui cuplu esențial, în care al doilea termen este alteritatea. And the last one, the tenth need, the need to transcendent, nevoia de transcendență, și aici ne aflăm la modul superior de cea mai înaltă complexitate pe care o poate căpăta nevoia de a da un sens vieții. Practic, este nevoia de a te contura, de a te cățăra, așa cum în copilărie ne cățăram în copaș pe garduri și săream gardul de curiozitate, așa și în viață de tot timpul să ne cățărăm, să aflăm, să vrem să aflăm altceva și poate să fim altceva. I stop here and again, I apologize for the others because I also spoke in Romanian, but I wanted to say these 10 needs which are very precious to me and to us. Now, please, Dr. Marcus, talk about the book, not the need.
The book we have in attention is in several respects more than its title says. The main focus is obviously the economy of Germany after the Second World War. However, the ambition of the authors is not of a descriptive and narrative nature. He wants to understand and to be able to explain what happened, and he realizes that in this respect he feels the need to considerably enlarge both the space and the temporal perspective. So we have the chance to follow his courageous scientific, cultural, and spiritual enterprise. First of all, the whole history of Germany is involved, and its natural context, the whole European history. But history does not refer in this book only to the material aspects of social life. The challenge proposed by the Mureșan is to convince us that economics is organically related, also in most cases in an indirect way, to cultural, scientific, philosophical, spiritual, religious activities. The present is organically related to the past, and you can understand the former only with reference to the latter. The economic financial activities are organically related to the cultural, philosophical, ethical, spiritual activities, and you cannot explain the former otherwise than by reference by means of the latter. This is much more than the so-called interdependence of orders, the slogan developed by some economists in the first half of the past century, in the first half of the past century, regarding the need to interact economic order, social order, administrative order, political order. And this, but this interdependence of orders prepares the way to today's total interaction. A whole chapter of the book, which is the longest one, has the title Philosophical and Historical Roots for the Social Market Economy. All causal links leading step by step from old Greek philosophy to Middle Age, Christian and secular philosophy, Catholic, Protestant and Jewish are all involved. The dramatic itinerary of Germany in the second half of the previous century is followed. How economics and ethics are interacting is a permanent issue. Now, we can ask what kind of education did receive Ștefan Sorin Mureșan in order to face successfully such a complex task. The answer is in his unusual universal background, obtained during a long period, beginning with his graduation from a German school in Romania, then a mechanical engineering degree at the Polytechnic University Cluj-Napoca, then studies of philosophy, theology, international relations, European history, international business law, then diplomatic studies, then PhD in economics, and post-graduation work specialization research center in foreign affairs in German Federal Parliament in Bonn. And let us add that Ștefan Sorin Mureșan's historical mentor is George Barițiu, a member of the Austrian Parliament in a period in the second half of the 19th century, but whose intellectual formation displayed a similar complexity from theology, philology, and history until economics, finance, and engineering. Economics cannot be understood in absence of reference to all this context. Now, Mureșan understood that in a globalized world, in all respects, communication, information, computation, economic, finance, policy, science, culture, his answer has to be according to the today cognitive globalization. Mureșan is now 50 years old. This book is representative for his successful evolution as a scientist, as a European and world citizen, and as a human being. Thank you for attention.
Thank you very much. And now I give the floor to Andreas Freitag.
Yes. Thank you, Mrs. Chairman.
Okay.
Thank you.
If I
okay.
Just let me. You were introduced by Sorin, and I'd like to tell everyone that I have to run to the plenary to vote on the draft agenda, and then I'll be back.
Okay. Thanks again for hosting us, and thanks, Sorin, for inviting me to this book launch. I will take a perspective of a German here. And I want to add a few words on Sorin's life, but only the part I've known. And we met, we just agreed in 1999,
yeah.
When I was working in the institute founded by Alfred Müller-Amack in Cologne, so in the center of the Rhineland capitalism. And Sorin was working in the embassy. And when we got to know of his interest, we invited him to come and see us. So we frequently met discussing the issue, which then became a lifelong passion for Sorin, and I'm glad that this is the case. And I would like to thank him for this really comprehensive and very balanced book on the German policy model. I wouldn't talk about the book here. I would like to talk a bit about the importance of the book. Why is it so important that this book has been written by him? First is, as you already mentioned, the most of the literature on the social market economy model is in German, by Germans. There are a few translations, a few handbooks by Germans in English, but there are only very, very few foreigners who have taken the trouble to delve so deeply into the matter like Sorin has done, which of course is only possible if you command the language as perfectly as Sorin has a command of German. That is number one. The second reason why this book is so important is that the model is widely misunderstood. The latest example is The Economist of, say, 2, 3, 4 weeks ago, when there was an article about auto-liberalism, particularly the German obsession with austerity. And it was obviously by the new editor, Mrs. Minton Beddoes, who also speaks excellent German, but she didn't read the literature on all liberalism and social market economy. So that was rather a caricature than a serious article. I was tempted to write a letter, but I thought it doesn't make any sense at all. So I think this is really a problem, that the model is not widely understood. So here we have the chance to correct this. And I'm very grateful that you took the chance. Third one is, and this is also very important, you mentioned it, the model has much in common with modern or fashionable Anglo-Saxon thinking. So what is called the new institutional economics is closely related to this school. Political economics or public choice has elements in the school, and even supply-side economics and demand-side economics as a pair, intertwined pair, is related to that. And it is acknowledged by many scholars that this is the important thinking. Rules play an important role for policymaking, and the enforcement of rules play an important role. And I think here we have an example of thinking in rules after a period of disaster, which includes rules for the government itself. So, and much of what has been written in the name of social market economy or auto-liberalism has been written in different languages, methodological languages, in other schools of thought. And here is much overlap. It's good that the Anglo-Saxon world has the chance to read about this overlap. That is why I think it's another important aspect. Another one is, and this is a sad one, in politics these days, the model is not really applied. We mentioned it. So take one of the principles, competence and liability. Those who have the competence must be liable for their action. And if you look at the bank rescue packages, the European rescue packages, you see there is a mismatch. There is there's competence on the side of, say, the banks, but who is liable? Taxpayers. There's obviously a mismatch in this. And you can find other examples. Central bank independence was another one mentioned. My explanation for this is Olsonian, in the sense that vested interests have become more and more powerful, which was one reason why Walter Eucken and his colleagues started to think about a new economic order. So we must think about a renaissance of say, economic order. How you call it doesn't matter much. Yeah? So therefore, I think it's enormously important that we have an outsider taking a perspective. Outsider is not mentioned in any way disrespectively, of course. It's just somebody who is not raised and educated in Germany takes this perspective and shows us the enormous potential of this model for ourselves as well as for others, but with all the caveats you mentioned. You can't just translate this sort of model to other societies. But there have been societies who have tried to translate such kind of model and learned, and quite successfully so, just to mention Estonia as one of them. So I'm really grateful that this book is out and that we have the chance to read it, and that you hopefully have the chance to read it, and that it spurs a new debate on social market economy in a modern, of course, in a modern form. And we don't have to talk about the 1950s again. We have to talk about the 2000s or 2010s. And I think there's much potential for it. Again, I would like to thank you, but not. I would like to end without a contradiction, because that you wanted to have a debate.
I like debate.
You mentioned a strength, the current account surplus, as one German strength. I would say it's a weakness, because it reflects our capital exports. We need investment desperately in our country, and we save a lot, but we don't invest everything in our country. We invest a lot of our savings elsewhere, and some of the investment wasn't very clever, as we now observed when we looked into the ECB's balance sheet. So I want to make the point that there are many strengths, but the current account is not part of it. Thank you very much.
I will not answer now. I'll answer during the question time. I just pass over the word to Dirk Hazel in the name of Mrs. Makovey. Thank you, Andreas, very much. Thank you. I'll reply later.
Well, thank you very much indeed, and I'm very grateful to have had the opportunity to read this masterpiece. And confirming what you said in your presentation just now, for me as a non-German, it really is highly educational. And it's much easier, having read the book, to understand the pride in the achievements of the social market economy, which are not just economic, but today Germany, in some very important respects, is a more democratic country and a better place to live than my country, the UK. I did ask the advice of a friend on what to say about the social market economy, and I said, well, why don't you talk about Keith Joseph? Because he was the main brain behind Thatcherism. And it is true that Margaret Thatcher did indeed introduce important supply-side reform. However, I think there are more arguments against than for that suggestion. The first one is conceptual. Keith Joseph was very fond of saying, he'd always got a laughter in Britain at the time, that to put the word social in front of any other word had the effect of reversing its meaning. And he would then go through a list of words, social science, social policy, social service, saying that from that point of view, it's not a terribly promising suggestion that my friend made. Now, secondly, there is the practical record of Thatcher's government. When she took office in the second quarter of 1979, inflation was 10.6%. after this great, glorious era, when she left office in 1994, the last quarter of 1990, inflation was still 10%. During her term of office, unemployment rose from 5.4% to 7.1%, and that was deliberate. And it actually took a Labour government in 1998 to make the Bank of England more independent of government. So it doesn't sound very social market economy there. Another aspect, point three, was the trend under Thatcher was very much against co-decision in the workplace. There was a massive squeeze on the power of organised labour, and within their corporate structures, the trend was unambiguously towards the Führerprinzip. Four, Sorin has rightly said that Thatcher's deindustrialisation now looks very bad. It looked very bad at the time, actually. And it created social tensions that are still very much apparent in Britain. And Sorin's book is very interesting on the Christian roots of subsidiarity. I would say that the deindustrialisation in the provinces of Britain was possible only under Thatcher, because the British state itself was so centralised. If you compare the north of England and North Rhine-Westphalia in terms of population, estuarial access, and maritime access, the balance of country and cities and towns, they're very similar. And I would say that the doctrine of subsidiarity, with a federal structure in North Rhine-Westphalia, has contributed greatly to the standard of living there still being more than 50% higher than in the north of England. And the last point I would say, against my friend, is that despite the North Sea oil bonanza, Thatcher left office with Britain as a country without infrastructure. And in contrast to the social market's long-term holistic analysis based on the common good and unity, we have seen in Britain far too much short-termism and self-enrichment. However, there is a similarity of the social market approach, at least in terms of objectives, if not results, to an earlier tradition in the Conservative Party, the pre-Thatcherite one-nation conservatism. And that's not to be confused with what David Cameron now describes as one-nation. And the one-nation politics, last applied under Ted Heath, did seek policies in the interest of the United Nations. It sought accommodation of social objectives, and it well understood that all this was much easier to achieve if you could sustain economic growth. And there was support with the One Nation School for competition, balanced interests, freedom, socially homogenized beliefs, and social peace within the free market. Those were the objectives. Now, if you move forward, of course, neoliberalism shares very, very important positive aspects of the social market, as Sorin notes. But the practical operation of neoliberalism, certainly in my country, has been very greatly to strengthen the powerful and to polarise society. And it has also greatly exacerbated a trend Sorin detects in Germany, which is of socially successionist egotism. Turning to another theme, monetary stability, Sorin repeatedly mentions the post-1971 increases in public debt and its uses to overstate Anglo-Saxon economic performance compared, for example, to Germany. But I think it is fair as a point to say that the United States did have to deal with the financial and other consequences of the Vietnam War, and as owners of the world's monopoly reserve currency at the time, they of course had very great freedom in how they did that. Ted Heath, the then Conservative Prime Minister, was very much well aware, even then, that if there was competition for the American dollar from a European currency, that ought to lead both the United States and the European market to better monetary practice. Well, that was the theory. And then moving forward, of course, Reagan did have to outspend the Soviet Union on the military to win the Cold War. But he also had, frankly, a domestic political agenda. To create a deficit through cutting tax did effectively place in Reagan's America a lower maximum cap on public spending. And that is an objective that may or may not be compatible with the social market. Now, Sorin repeatedly notes that the British debt is 500%. You know, I have read more pro-British books in my life, sorry. But he repeatedly notes that the British debt is 500% of GDP, and that German, Japan and America all have debt on about 300% of GDP. And he correctly observes both the burden for future generations and also that some form of monetary rebalancing will be likely fairly soon. So I'm going to offer the thought that one hesitates always to make in front of anybody from Germany, but I do myself wonder whether the inevitable consequence of intergenerational equity and of geopolitical interests will at some stage be coordinated and significant price inflation in the West. In talking about the social market economy, Sorin talks about externalities. Now, ultimately, any economic model has to be a global Darwinian survivor and winner. And in a way, that's the thought behind what the EPP said in 2009, and Sorin quotes, as much market as possible, as much state as necessary. But Sorin favourably and correctly compares the social market's efforts to align economic, social and environmental sustainability to those of neoliberalism, which has generally tended to be much more relaxed about externalising social and environmental costs. Now, the European Union, as the world's largest economy, must have the strength. This is really its justification. It's analogous to what happened in the late 1940s in Germany. The European Union must have the strength to sustain the European model of seeking to minimise social and environmental externalities. And then moving on within TTIP and NATO, and the United States to create an overwhelming global economic and political force for freedom. On the social side, clearly a policy based on Christian thinking is more likely to care about the work-life balance and the integrity of the family. And for those who read the book, Sorin offers interesting ideas on the role of active pensioners and of unemployment benefit as a retraining scholarship. And on the environment, he rightly draws attention to the Christian basis behind environmentalism, certainly in Germany. In Britain, environmental debate has tended to be much more Marxist materialist. Germany has indeed created a strong world-class environmental sector of its economy. And as Sorin rightly notes, that is a result of enforced government policy. In fact, much business throughout the economy does depend on regulation, including in the Anglo-Saxon model. There's hardly any economy in the world that's more bureaucratic than that of the United States. But perhaps Germany went too far in aspects of its environmental regulation. For example, in the last decade, there were comparisons the German Green Dot packaging scheme, which is in the press again today, with the British market-based scheme, which achieved broadly comparable environmental outputs for 20% of the cost of the German scheme. Sorin repeatedly notes the need for an economy to produce things and not just to supply services. However, there is in the modern economy a trend in any event towards dematerialization. It's both an environmental necessity and a consequence of the internet. So, for example, each new generation of mobile phone, in very broad terms, both contains less material and more intellectual property. So I don't quite see that as a very direct contrast. Finally, on that, I could not agree more strongly with Sorin on the need in our economy for enhanced faith and ethical values. The 2007-09 financial shock was a function in part here of incomplete construction of the euro, but it was also an accident obviously waiting to happen in a system that had become too short-termist and was amoral. So we need to return to the objectives of Earhart, and I personally am immensely optimistic about Europe's educated young, particularly those to get the opportunity to read the Sovereign's book. The end.
Thank you very much. Now we'll hear from Matthias Bauer. And Matthias, very briefly, is senior economist at the European Center for International Political Economy in Brussels. And his areas of research include international trade, European fiscal and capital market economy. Matthias, you have the floor.
Well, thanks a lot for this kind introduction, and thanks again for hosting this event, which I think is very important for educative purposes. I am German by passport, but I take the perspective of, I would say, social liberal. I like to term social liberal, but we have got to know that it's not, it's apparently not so useful to put the word social in front of another particular area. Attached to liberal attitudes. Well, first of all, let me say that Mr. Murasan has indeed written a very comprehensive and remarkable book about the social market economy, and this book reflects a massive amount of reading. And particularly the reading about the theological, the philosophical, and also the intellectual roots of what we in Germany called social market economy, is very valuable for any scholar that's dealing with economic orders, be it capitalism, be it socialism, or the third way. You may have noticed that I stressed we in Germany, and I did so because people around the world, most people around the world, and even academic economists do not know what the term social market economy actually means, and they are not at all familiar with the concept of what's behind social market economy. And this seems to be a paradox, particularly against the background that we in the European Union, in Europe, have Article 3 of the Lisbon Treaty, which states that Europe shall strive for a highly competitive social market economy that is aiming at full employment and social progress. The notion of a highly competitive social market economy supposedly should satisfy both the advocates for market economy and those of a social economy, irrespective of what social economy actually means. And now what we see is that citizens as well as politicians frequently quarrel about the right balance between market forces on the one hand and government interventions for the sake of social objectives on the other hand. And let me just give you an example of my own experiences. When I was working as an economist at Konrad Adenauer Foundation in Berlin, the promotion of the concept of social market economy was one of my most honorable duties. And I should note that, being the political foundation of the Christian Democratic Union, Angela Merkel's party, basically, the foundation, Adenauer Foundation, is strongly engaged in 80 countries around the world with the dissemination of the political legacy of Ludwig Erhard, who was, as we already heard, a former economics minister of Germany and even a chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany. And he is now indeed known as the great inventor and the marketer of the German social market economy. And I should also say that by the time he and Alfred Müller-Aumarck promoted the term social market economy, it was heavily tackled by the Social Democrats. They rather described it as unsocial capitalism. And when I was presenting the concept of social market economy in various countries, most of the time in a nutshell, of course, the audience quite often was very surprised. And it was not so surprised about the economic achievements of Germany after the Second World War. It was rather surprised about our understanding of the meaning of social. In Latin America, for example, many people thought of socialism when they first became acquainted with the term social market economy. Latin American citizens, policymakers, were actually keen on learning more about social security systems and the legislation about compulsory representation of labor unions in management boards, for example. In the Baltic states, on the other hand, people showed a great deal of mistrust about the role of the government after being introduced to the concept of social market economy. Contrary to the Latin Americans, people in the Baltics have generally been far more wary and doubtful about the role of the government in the economy. And the Baltic people were indeed more open to principles related to self-responsibility, personal initiative, and private property. They were less open, for example, to a tax system that is based on a progressive tax rate that forces people actually with higher incomes to finance a bigger share of public expenditures. So the lesson I have drawn from these dialogues is that there is a substantial lack of understanding in the world about what the concept of social market economy actually involves. And for this reason, Mr. Murasan's work on the philosophical, on the intellectual roots, and particularly his detailed outline about the history of actual implementation of several legislations in Germany, is highly valuable for every student, every scholar, and every policymaker in Europe. And as we already heard, to my knowledge as well, Mr. Rosen's book is actually a part of a very rare selection of books on the social market economy that have been translated into English language. And against the background of Germany's proven track record, it is therefore highly desirable that this book finds a wide audience, not only in Europe, but also in those many transformation economies that are actually seeking and aiming for economic convergence with the developed world. For those countries in particular, this book, which involves and takes very valuable ideas, may actually pave their way to become a millionaire, not overnight, but over a certain period of time in which good economic governance and social institutions, good social institutions, are independent. And now I would like to touch up on one of the most pressing challenges for the core of the social market economy that has already been addressed by previous speakers. It is the observation that many political leaders, many representatives of civil society organizations, and also many religious leaders do not actually discriminate between either socialism and capitalism and the so-called third way, which is the social market economy. And people often get confused with what actually is social, which is, of course, always a function of the economic and political developments of a certain period of time. And although for me the term social market economy has always been a buzzword rather than and a rake rather than a consistent economic framework, the core of the concept is about a market-oriented, non-socialist economic order. And this is an economic order that acknowledges scarcity of resources. It also acknowledges the coordinating world of prices, and it also acknowledges the incentives of a sound property rights structure. Yet, for most people, the concept of social market economy does not offer a clear-cut framework on how an economy should work, on how welfare should be created, and on how welfare should actually be redistributed. I could make reference to Greece and the Eurozone crisis, and we will certainly discuss this later on, but I will give another example that frequently strikes me. It is often argued that the Catholic Church, more precisely Catholic social teaching, has had a substantial impact on how intellectuals as well as policymakers fought about economic orders after the World War II, particularly in Germany. And against the background, and we can also find this in this very long chapter about the theological roots of the social market economy, against this background of the social question that arose in the late 19th century, there were a few social encyclicals, basically letters written by the Pope or published in name of the Pope, that called for rights and duties of capital and labor. They called for wage justice and also the importance of individual self-responsibility. I said in chapter 2 of this book, Mr. Murasan carefully, really carefully elaborates on the role of Catholic social teaching and the impact on thinking about economic laws in Germany after World War II. And he argues, and I want to quote here, he argues that according to Catholic social teaching, the most efficient method to achieve social justice and common good in practice, namely in legislation and institutions, is the application of the principles of solidarity and subsidiarity. These are the basic principles of social order in contemporary Germany and all over the single market economies in the European Union. The encyclicals, the letters of today's Pope, Pope Francis, who is Argentinian by passport, do not exactly follow the zeitgeist of the Catholic Church back then. I was talking about pieces that were published in 1891 and 1930. In his latest release, Laudato Si, Pope Francis makes the case for new forms of economic growth, and he even calls for negative economic growth. Thereby, he implicitly assumes that we already live in a post-scarcity world. Francis also argues that we need to think of containing growth by setting some reasonable limits. Moreover, and this is striking, moreover, the Pope states that the time has come to accept decreased growth in some parts of the world in order to provide resources for our parts of the world. So his claims, from my perspective, his claims clearly demonstrate that the concept of social market economy together with the widely acknowledged merits are either unknown to the Pope at the Vatican, or they are simply not regarded as a proper economic framework that meets modern world's needs. And yeah, we all know that we have not yet arrived in a post-scarcity world, and it's certainly intellectually appealing that in a post-scarcity world we might not see a world for private property rights, for prices, profits and losses. But as long as resources, income, products and services are scarce, we are in the need for market forces, we are in the need for private property, and we are in need for exchange of property by mutual consent. And this is exactly in the spirit of the social market economy. And I therefore hope that Mr. Murison's book becomes an economic educator that teaches the principles of a proven economic system to those who have not heard about it so far, but also to those who refuse to learn and in most instances even refuse to seriously listen. And maybe the book will also arrive at the shelves and even the desks of those people who write for The Economist. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now I open the floor for questions. Please don't hesitate to ask. Puneți întrebări, vă rog. I will also say in Romanian. And for the Romanians, if you want to ask in Romanian, I will translate them. We have a question here.
Yes, my name is Casper Jürgens, and I'm amazed about your contributions, all of them. But I especially like the one from Dirk, maybe because he made this nice remark on the prefix social. among my ancestors is Rudolf von Gehring, who has been a jurist and invented the social function of law as such. And that's why I forward present a question to you. When you look at TTP, and TTIP now, and consider different order frames in Asia, in Europe, and in the Americas, and consider different levels of maturities in those economy areas. Wouldn't it be a nice idea to have a, let's say, European, Asian control group to check the standards America tries to implement globally by these two agreements. Check culturally, of course, socially, and under the aspects of responsibility. What you mentioned, Andreas, the liability competence connection. Thank you.
le luăm din sală?
Alte întrebări? Other questions? There. Îndrăzniți. We have a question.
Hello, my name is Sanya Anen. I would like to ask the author, Mr. Murashan, and of course the other panelists, maybe to leave the position of an economic historian for a moment and look at this issue from a practitioner's point of view. So I'm referring to the Romanian economy and what lessons we can learn from this for our own economic development. It seems to me, and I'd like you to challenge this view, that the countries in which the order liberal ideas were applied and were successfully applied had the benefit of certain preconditions, such as a strong industrial tradition, a competitive level to start with, a strong institutions, an educated workforce, and I'm wondering if applying the order liberal ideas can lead to developing these conditions, or they are necessary. Because when we look at the countries that have broken the poverty trap, and I'm talking about China, the BRICS countries, etc. They tend to use completely anti-liberal policies. They tend to use heterodox policies, a lot of state intervention, state investments. They tend to run overheated economies, a lot of inflation, and so on. So again, what is the practical value of the social market economy for Romania?
Other questions? If you have other questions, ask them now, and then you'll get the answers. You had a question?
Yes, actually, it's not a question. More or less, it's I wrote it down here. I beyond the national vocation, the question was, I think, addressed. But I note here the mismatch that Professor Freitag talked about. Liability and competence, and that we are actually living an age where we capitalize profits and socializing losses. So probably a short comment on that from the author.
Okay.
Okay. Go ahead, quick.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to reading your book, so congratulations on your book. Now, having studied very much in depth the German model, I'm wondering, since we applied some of the German policies at European level, what is your opinion on the efficiency of austerity measures? Thank you.
Others? Good. So I have four questions, and they have to be answered very quickly, because we have some sandwiches and a glass of champagne outside. And the administration is running us, so they leave if we don't go there, and they take the champagne as well. You're the first to answer.
Dirk.
You go.
You want me to go on the first one? Right. I will just answer the first one. I mean, it would have been much better if the Doha round had succeeded, but in the absence of a successful Doha round, it is very important to keep global trade going, particularly when we have really seen problems with the neoliberal order. With the 2007-2009 crash. I am absolutely clear myself that given the global balance of power as it is clearly emerging, it is in the interest of every single European and every single North American that we get a good TTIP treaty and that we together are allies, really effectively for a social market model, but maybe a bit more free market in North America, and for democracy and for shared defence. I am absolutely no doubt at all about that. And I'm also not remotely in doubt about the fact that if the Chinese detect anything wrong from their point of view, they will let the other side of that equation know very promptly indeed. I mean, it is quite interesting that even the British government has gone against the current American administration to support the Chinese Alternative Development Bank. So I think we do live in a world of shared interests. We really so much today have a shared interest in North America. There's no two ways about it.
Sure. Yeah, let me just add one comment. From my perspective, it would make sense to get the Asian countries at the table as an observer. But at the moment, we are not able to negotiate contracts like TTIP and not even TPP, because in TTIP, for example, we are striving for an agreement on competition and public procurement. Now, when we look to Asia, we see a lot of state capitalist countries. And it's technically not possible to talk to the state capital system about opening up public procurement and setting up a competition law that is equivalent to what we see in the European Union.
So, if I may, I would like to comment on, I'm not an expert on Romania, but I think what would be an achievement is a growing middle class. And a growing middle class, I think, is the backbone of a democracy as well as a driving force for institutional improvements. So my take is that the Chinese model will come to severe difficulties when there's a middle class that is not accommodated with political rights. So it's easy, say, to run a market economy as in a dictatorship up to a certain point. And the advantage of this model is that it is, and we didn't go into the details, so the role of small, medium-sized enterprises is crucial. The role of education is crucial. And I think that is an education through these companies. So I think there are many lessons to learn. I wouldn't dare to say which one at which stage for the Romanian economy, but I don't think that the developmental stage is a really good alternative, if I may say so. And austerity, that's an interesting question. Austerity is one part of the reform package when public spending has gone overboard. But the most relevant thing, I think, is a sort of supply-side reform, which then may even allow to deviate a bit from the black zero, or how you would like to call it, from the austerity. Yeah? But, so that's why I mean the Economist article is a caricature, because they stress that all the liberals are only thinking about austerity, which is nonsense. But they think about the proper mix of economic, political and social order, and in the cases we all have in mind, there's obviously a big problem in that respect. And austerity then would support it, but it's, and it will be supported by reforms, but it's not the only, it's not a panacea. Thanks.
So, for the first issue addressed to me, question Romania. The problem was in Romania that the social tensions which we inherited in 1990, which means between the elite of the country and the population, was so big that once there was freedom, political freedom and economic freedom came on the market, people were uneducated and in fact unprepared to take over the industrial infrastructure which existed in the country. And the industrial infrastructure was left at the hands of everybody who was faster. And this is an effect which we have now, the phenomenon of corruption. It's a complex phenomenon as a transition, effect of an unsteered transition. The only way which would have, my opinion, would have been theoretically possible to have a sustainable transition was through a transition dictatorship. The Chinese did the same, 1978, after the Cultural Revolution, until 9, it's basically a transition dictatorship to a socialist market economy, not a social. The Japanese did the same from 1866, samurai dictatorship of the Meijis. They brought Japan 1900 into modernity, but we didn't manage in Romania. The population, we were not ready to understand what market economy is, what freedom is, how do we deal with this, that freedom has responsibility. So the model, let's say, the German model often is misunderstood that it's a German model or so. It's not necessarily a German model. The Germany is the country which succeeded to make an order systematic, which means even now in any country there is a minimum of contents of order. When you go to a ATM, to bank cash machine in any country, if you press the button €500 or $500, you get $500. There is no mistake, neither in Greece, nor in London, nor in Singapore, it's 500. So it's a minimum of rules, which we have to all respect, otherwise it cannot work. And this is the country which managed to make a set of rules, which can be, as systemic, looked as an orientation for the others who have transitions, who have to go through transition periods. And we are now in another transition to globalization. So Romania, I think, needs a lot of order. And the question is whether people will accept order by themselves, or they will be forced by poverty to accept order and to take responsibility. And we hope that a critical mass of acceptance will come into the public conscience. And regarding German policy of austerity, I think austerity is not necessarily austerity, because the government cannot spend money they don't have by taking new loans. It's not healthy to spend money which you don't have, project in the future. Of course, for a time to bridge for a time a certain crisis, there might be some bridging loans acceptable, but the problem is that public debt and also personal debt has in many countries been systemic, has become a way of life, and this will not bring us forward. It will bring conflicts, if we go to living on credit as a systemic solution. This is not a solution, I think. This can be for some time until you find the real longer term solution. As far as I'm concerned, for other questions, so the book it can be read also from Springer publisher. You can download chapters. They put a high price. I'm sorry, but it's not my decision. If you find the book on, it's not the publisher decided that. I have nothing to do with the price. But you can download individual chapters of it in e-form.
For free.
It's not for free. I think they put for a chapter it's €30, and they put for the book €139 for a hard copy book, and the ebook is €107. It's not my decision, but it's they who decide. They
okay.
They pay for everything. I just did the text.
Thank you very much. But anyway, I will take care to send you for free all these brief
yes, the charts.
The slides, yes, the charts. As closing remark, I'd like to say again that I'm proud to have been helpful to launch this book, and also to be with these great panelists. And I enjoy the debate. I think Sorin will go forward and write more books, and keep it like this, interdisciplinary, because this is the world we live in, and this is the future. The old world which has passed was only one discipline, one person, one discipline at a time, is gone, is not coming back. And now I invite you all outside. Actually, Sorin invites you all outside for a glass of champagne and a few sandwiches. Thank you very much.
It would have been nice to have some comments on what the other authors say, but I think Monica has some deadline going, and we also planned only on